It's January 28th, 2024, and welcome to episode 273 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
Will I ever... The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, snow, and Ethernet, I guess. I'm Paul Hagstrom near Boston. I am joined by two retro computing enthusiasts this time. Quinn Dunkey in, what does that say? British Columbian Hermit.
Yes, I'm the British Columbian Hermit this week. Hello. It is kind of spring-like here. We had that crazy cold spell that just like buried Canada there for a week. But that's over, and now it's basically spring outside, so it's lovely here.
Excellent. Also joining us is Earl Evans in Portland. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing well. And the Icemageddon that we had here in Portland, I think Canada sent us that. I think it was your fault, Quinn.
Yeah, I heard about the ice storms you guys had down there. That was crazy.
It was, and it locked up the city for a week. But we're all thawed out now. And I think, like you, having unseasonably warm weather today, it's going to be sunny and in the 60s Fahrenheit, those funky Fahrenheit temperatures that we're going to have. So it should be a nice day here. How are you, Paul?
Here it's all kinds of snow. so we have you know, the cold air came down, and actually early today, I began the day in Canada, and there was a storm coming up north, and I sort of like I got in the car very early in the morning and like raced at the storm to try to get home before it reached my home, and almost made it. But so it's snow everywhere now.
At the worst of the cold spell that hit Canada last week, Calgary hit minus 40, which for fun fact, Fahrenheit or Celsius doesn't matter. The scales actually line up at about minus 40. So those are actually the same temperature. That's the temperature where you can like crack an egg and it will freeze before it hits the ground. Or you can throw water into the air and it will snow back down on you. All sorts of fun stunts can happen at minus 40.
Right. Very quickly, and then you go back inside. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And turn up the furnace. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So we've been, you know, this is episode, what did I say, 273, and we've been kind of like tracking the years that correspond at least to the last two digits for a while. 1973 is the year that we would be talking about this time. And there's some lists of things that happened in 1973. Among the things that happened was Ethernet. Ethernet. Robert Metcalfe created Ethernet at Xerox PARC. Xerox PARC. This must be like the Xerox PARC year, or like, you know, just time.
This was coming into the sweet spot here for sure. Yeah.
I think we'll talk more about this. Another thing that happened in 1973 was that the first computer monitor was released as part of the Xerox Alto with a CRT. I don't know. I find that surprising.
Yeah, that's a bold claim, first computer monitor. I wonder how that's defined.
Yeah. But if it was with the Alto, then it wasn't, you know, commercially available.
Yeah, so. I mean, does that mean standalone CRT display not meant for television or something?
I guess it must, and not being an oscilloscope.
Yeah, interesting. Claims of first are always dubious. Mm-hmm. That's a bold one.
Robert Metcalfe created Ethernet at Xerox PARC on May 22nd, 1973. Quite a lot to do in a day, I'm sure, but
big day, yeah.
They were wizards. Yeah, there.
Yeah, I did nothing that day, probably. What'd you do today? I invented Ethernet. I had a grilled cheese for lunch. That was kind of fun.
Right. Anyway, yeah. So Ethernet. I mean, we could talk a little bit about that. I think we have various experiences with it. I probably among us have the least technical experience, but I do remember my early days with Ethernet having having to deal with all the different sort of like adapter, you know, versions of Ethernet that you know, you had to get an AAUI or an AUI or some sort of thing for the Mac to talk to something, and that was a big hassle. I'm very glad that we you know have these wires that now have different category numbers and they all look the same and have different capacities, but you know, at least they all fit.
Yeah, and they all will probably work. Like, yeah, anything with that connector, if you plug it in, it's probably going to work. Might not be as fast as it could be or whatever, but it'll work. Yeah, early Mac stuff in particular for networking was really terrible. I mean, Macs were off on their own corner networking-wise for a really long time because Apple resisted the industry standards for so long. They really wanted to make Apple Talk a thing, and they wanted to make local talk a thing. And yeah, so it was hard to network Macs for a long time. In the early days, I think it's easy to forget now that we have Ethernet. I mean, Ethernet was such a revolution just for standardizing wired networking, because before that, there was so many standards. I mean, there was there was Novell and all of the PC stuff, and then there was Token Ring, and there was ATM, and there was, yeah, all these other standards that kind of competed there for a while, and Ethernet kind of won the day, thankfully.
Ethernet went through a lot of evolution over time. It's really interesting. The first Ethernet that I played with wasn't what they called the thick net with those AUI connectors that you're talking about, but we had cards and devices that used those. So we had to get those adapters that Paul was talking about that would translate an AUI to like the 10Base2, the coaxial Ethernet, or later on Twisted Pair, which was just an absolute dream, you know, after dealing with, I think, Quinn, before the show, you were talking about being in a lab and having those coax connectors all over the place. And if people remember that you would hook up the T connectors and then you would tee off the Ethernet, and at the ends you had to have the terminators. And if anything in there, like somebody stepped in and crimped your coax, or if they just didn't know what a terminator was, or why do I need this thing, and just took it off, then all of a sudden all of your Ethernet would break. And yeah, in some of the offices that I worked in, people didn't want to wait for facilities to come along and put the nicely terminated wall plates in. So they would just knock out lift up the false ceiling and throw the coax over the top and network another. It was a jungle. It was an absolute jungle.
It was. It was a double-edged sword, because the physical cabling of 10Base2, or ThinNet, as also known, was actually really nice. Like, it was coax, but it was very, very thin coax. It's not like you would think of like your cable TV, where it's this big, thick cable. It was very, very thin, and those BNC connectors were really nice. They're really solid feeling, and you can't pull them out by accident, and they're all metal. So that I thought this mechanical structure of it all was very nice. But yeah, because it was terminated and it required termination, and because it was point to point, it was so easy to create spaghetti messes where you had six different computers in four different rooms that were all kind of teed together in some unknown way in the acoustic ceiling, as you said. And maybe there's a terminator on there somewhere, maybe there isn't, maybe there's two, and trying to figure out why the network isn't working. It was always like a number of terminators other than one was usually the root of the issue, and trying to figure out where the extra or the missing one was a nightmare. One of my first sort of IT jobs was in university, and we had multiple Spark Station labs. We had Sun Microsystems Sparks in the labs, and they all ran 10Base2. And they were all the labs were on one network. So there would all the machines in the room would be on a thin net loop, and then there'd be one line going up over the wall into the next lab, and those would all be on a loop, and then there'd be one terminator at the end somewhere. And being students in the middle of the night, we'd like to fidget to stay awake, and those coaxial BNC connectors were very fidget friendly, and so you'd sit there, the cables would just be lying on the desk sometimes, and you'd just be fidgeting, and you'd pop that terminator off, and the whole network would go down, and no one would know why. And sometimes it would take days to figure out, like, you're two rooms over and your network dies, and you don't know what's going on, and so you're, yeah, trying to find the IT guy, and then he has to go around and check all the cables, and yeah, it was a very fragile system.
It's interesting that Ethernet was kind of where Old Ethernet was where you could really see physics and the real world intersecting with computing. Like you say, if you took off one of those terminators, then everything would break. And that was because of the line impedance on the coax had to remain correctly because Ethernet uses collision detection and yada yada. Oh, that's right too. That the that coaxial Ethernet would have collisions that would have to be detected, and depending on the traffic, that could affect things. Whereas today we use switched Ethernet, like switched telephone. It uses direct point to point, and you don't have contention between the devices that are on the Ethernet. But I just remember a couple really funny stories. Like one was, we had a big campus where we had Ethernet, and we linked our buildings together with the Ethernet thick net, the giant thick cable. And the interesting thing about that was it would come into these giant wiring closets, and you would have enormous loops, and you couldn't make the loop any tighter, because if you did, you would throw off the physical characteristics of the signal that was happening on that giant loop. And if you wanted to insert a new connection into that loop, there were these things called vampire taps that would actually screw into the wire. And the wire, you had to screw into it at particular intervals based on the spacing, based on the wavelengths of what was going on. It was just really interesting how physical and finicky all of that was compared to modern networks. It just seems like the Stone Ages.
Yeah, it's an interesting example of the trade-offs between physical simplicity and software complexity. So, the idea was that the ThinNet was physically very simple. It was this thin little coax. You just needed to run one all the way around the room and you're done. But then they tried to handle all the complexity on the software side, which it really wasn't up to, because they, like you say, there were physical collisions and impedance issues that couldn't be detected or fixed in software. So then now modern Ethernet, the software is much easier, but we've paid a price for that with the physical installation, because now a modern office building, you have Ethernet cables running from every computer to a switch. And so you've got these cable trays with 100 Ethernet cables running through the ceiling. So the physical installation of it has gotten much more elaborate and complex, but clearly a much more robust and simpler system, because any issue is isolated to one computer instead of bringing down whole sections of the network at a time.
Other things that happened in 1973, apart from the first computer monitor, the TV typewriter, which is kind of interesting. So do we know the TV typewriter?
No. Okay. Don't know what that is.
Lancaster made a device, an early device that would function as an early terminal. And it was an extremely popular project that really caught on.
Yeah, okay, I do know what this is. This is the thing that Woz wanted to build. Mm-hmm. He started going to the Homebrew Computer Club because they were all talking about how to build TV typewriters, and he wanted to build one. And he ended up building the Apple II instead, which, you know, pretty good move there. But this was actually what he was interested in, was building one of these. Okay, that's cool.
Yeah, I have this TV typewriter cookbook. I don't think I have an actual TV typewriter, though. But, it was one of those things that I thought, it'd be kind of interesting to try to do at some point.
It's funny, you'd need a TV, old RF-based television to even follow that book, I guess.
I wonder if it was all 7400 series TTL chips, or if it needed any special, like, bespoke chips that were available at the time but aren't available today. I was curious how much effort it would take to build one today. I don't know that answer.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Yeah, they had a lot of weird custom chips that you could buy in those days for, like, handling RF, signals and that kind of stuff, which maybe you wouldn't be able to get anymore.
Yeah, as I was saying that, I was thinking exactly that. It's like, I would like to try it, but it might actually turn out to be quite expensive, even though the thing about this was that it was kind of like a cheap, easy thing to build.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, if you scroll down a little bit, there's mention of on-screen text being generated by the Signetics 2513 character generator circuit, which I guess was a chip you could buy at Radio Shack in 1973, but not something you could buy today. Like, you'd never be able to find that chip today, I'm sure.
Although I think it's is it not the one that's in the Apple II? I think it may be. Those are
could be
very Apple II looking characters.
They are, yeah. Another popular video chip in those days was the Motorola. Was it the 6851, something like that? There was a text generator chip from Motorola that was very easy to plug into your homebrew terminal or whatever that would handle a lot of the issues of fonts and scrolling and so on for you. So, chips like that, I guess, made this kind of project pretty easy, relatively speaking.
But I'm sure at least for a certain set of people, that really kind of brought home the possibility of something like a computer. I mean, like you can type and see text. Even I don't think it could do very much, but you could type and see text.
Yeah, the point of them was to be able to connect to a mainframe, right? Because teletypes were expensive. So this was a way to, if you had access to your university's mainframe, I guess this would be a way to talk to it without having to buy a teletype. Mm-hmm. I think that was the idea behind them, why people were interested in building them. Other than it was just also neat to type and have text appear on the screen. Because, yeah, it's interesting how close that is to a computer. Like, that's like 85% of what, you know, the Apple II does in its most basic form. Or the Apple I, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, add a serial port to that and some ROM, and you've basically got an Apple I.
Yeah, I think that was kind of the design. Like, the design of the Apple I was essentially, you know, a microprocessor smashed up against like a terminal. I mean, you know, there's sort of like two distinct, you can sort of see the two distinct areas, right?
Yeah. Yeah. To this day. Yeah. Like in the ROM, there's sort of those input and output pipes, those hooks that you can redirect in the way that keyboard input and output are handled. And that's a relic of those two separate systems. That's kind of the point where they spoke to each other was right there. Which allows you to do, that's why we can do those tricks like IN number 2 to get input from the serial port and stuff. That's all legacy from how the Apple I, those two halves talk to each other.
Yeah, that is it must have come up at some point, maybe in some, you know, previous discussion that we had, but it must have been when we were talking about the Commodore, because I mean, all this stuff is pretty opaque if you're new to the platform. Load $8,1. That's not something you're born knowing.
Yeah.
And for the Apple, if you want to redirect output, you type PR number and then the slot number of where your output is. And I mean, that's because it's a printer.
Yeah.
But I mean, otherwise it's.
Yeah. But yeah, and then by weird side effect, if you do that with slot 6, it reboots the machine and. It makes perfect sense when you build up from first principles, but to a Commodore user, like, why does PR number 6 reboot? What? That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and even weirder, also, IN number 6 will as well.
Yeah.
I think it's just as unintuitive as load quote star quote comma 8 comma 1.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Where did that come from?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, that one, I'm... As a new Commodore user, I'm slowly working my way through all that stuff. And yeah, I would like to know where some of that stuff comes from. I assume it's like loading, it's related to how the disk controller works. Like it's loading the catalog file or whatever off the disk. But if anybody can recommend references for that kind of stuff, it would be nice to know. Because right now I'm at that stage where you just sort of have all of these cryptic magic phrases that you type in to do stuff. Like, okay, I know I have to type that. And then when I type list, which to me should list a basic program, it actually lists the catalog on the disk. So I'm just going through the motions because that's what I know works, but I don't know why any of it is that way. So it'd be interesting to know.
I was just listening to one of the more recent, maybe it is the most recent Antic podcast. And I think it was Randy who was talking about making cheat sheets for his various computers, you know, like something for a modern person to like figure out, like if you want to get your thing to do something and you don't want to go through a year of, you know, learning curve, this is how you start.
Yeah, that would be great. I would love a retro computing enthusiast handbook that was like a cheat sheet for each of the major platforms. Like, here's how you load a game, here's how you catalog a disk, here's what you know, here's how you do whatever, here's what slot the 80 column card has to go in or whatever for each of these platforms.
Here's the poke that you do on your enemy's pet to fry their monitor.
I guess it would have to be some of it. I was also thinking it would be nice to have a resource for like, here's where to go for disk images, or like if you want to play games on the Apple II, just download Total Replay, you know, that kind of thing. But I guess that would have to be more like a website because that information is always going to be changing. But like one thing I've struggled with on my new Commodore adventure is where to get disk images. If you Google like ROM sites or disk image sites, you get a lot of very sketchy places, little corners of the internet that I'm not sure I want to download things from. So it would be nice to know what the family-friendly, legit place is to download Commodore disk images, and you know if there's any good anthologies or whatever to start with. That would be nice. Right.
Yeah, it's even worse if you want to download a driver.
Oh, yes. Oh, my gosh. Like an old driver or something like that you can't just get from the mainstream company? Yeah, those sites are... I don't know what's up with that.
6040, you have a like malware.
Exactly. Yeah. Half the time, my browser will warn me off and say, this is a dangerous site. And too bad.
Yeah, in the Apple world, one of our key tools is AT Pro, which allows you to, again, using that IN number input redirection trick, allows you to inject code directly into the Apple II from a modern machine and get it bootstrapped and generate a floppy disk basically from nothing. It's an amazing tool, but it requires a USB connection to your Apple II from your modern computer, which then requires a very specific FTDI driver. Mm-hmm. And turns out these USB serial adapters, half of them in the world are FTDI chips inside and half of them are some other chip. And so you have to buy multiples until you get the one that has the FTDI chip in it, because there's no way to know ahead of time. And then there's only very specific versions of the FTDI driver that actually work with ADT Pro for reasons that are unknown to all of us. So I think we've all spent some amount of time on sketchy sites trying to download vintage FTDI drivers, and then you upgrade your modern OS and it stops working again, and you have to try and find a different FTDI driver.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. We can, I guess, maybe move on to the items of interest and news, unless there's any other 1973 things.
Nope, I think we got it.
I think so. Okay. Oh, actually, one more thing. We should mention Garrett in the chat is saying that 1973, the UNIVAC Series 90 came out, and he spent a number of years as a systems programmer on them, and it was one of the greatest learning experiences of his life. And I think many of our reaction to that was UNIVAC still existed in 1973. That was certainly a shock to me. So interesting to know that they were still around.
Yeah, and the idea that in fact, I think that it was the System 90? That came out, like, it came out in 1973. First introduced in 1973.
Yeah. Wow, and you look at it and it looks like it's out of the 50s. Because, when I think of UNIVAC, I think of vacuum tube and relay machines from the 50s, which is very much what the UNIVAC 90 looks like, and even in 1973, that thing is...
I love computers that have knobs.
Yeah.
You just want to go up and turn them and see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a refrigerator for the folks at home. It's a refrigerator covered in knobs and LEDs. It looks like every computer in every bad sci-fi movie that you think that's not what computers look like. Well, one of them looked like that.
Yeah. I have a toy. I forget. Is it Fisher Price? Maybe it is.
My first UNIVAC.
Yeah, it's something sort of like that. I'm trying to quickly find a photo of it. Maybe I'll locate it. Oh yeah, here is a photo. It's not it's Play School. It's not it's not Fisher Price. But I do have one, and I'm trying to dig up a decent photo of it.
Oh yes, we've looked at this before. Yeah.
Yeah. So it has a little wheels that are supposed to represent like tape drives and a knob, and it has a tray that you put little punch cards in, and it's essentially like a quiz game. But anyway, this is the play and learn
computer.
That's
right. We did look at this. Yeah. The tape reels are actually knobs that you turn to expose little windows on. Mm-hmm. Cards that you insert. Yeah, that's right. I remember this thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've talked about this a bit in the past, I think. Oh, well, and it's from 1972, so it's almost on topic.
Yeah. So this is still what computers look like.
It really is my first UNIVAC.
It is.
Yeah.
I would love to have this. I don't $80 want to have this, but that is so cool.
I guess it is interesting how quickly computers went from this to a desktop thing, like in people's minds of like, what does a computer look like? like pretty much, I guess, instantly in 1976 or seven, it must have gone from this to what we think of.
About a 5-year span from this to when you could go buy a TRS-80.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting.
And it's probably pretty sad for, you know, Play School, who now have all this inventory.
Yeah. And like a factory full of injection molding dies set up to make this thing.
Right.
Which now instantly looks obsolete.
Yes, sad for them, and maybe even sadder for the computer companies that actually made the real ones.
Yeah.
That now had warehouses, and what am I going to do with this?
Yeah. Yeah, Christopher in the chat says that the UNIVAC 90 was apparently discontinued in 1986. So clearly the Apple IIgs is what killed it finally.
Right, exactly.
Why is everybody laughing?
Let me see if... here's a photo of mine.
Eh.
With the little cards.
Box and everything. Yeah. Holy cow, that thing's in great condition.
Yeah.
That box is mint. Jeez, where do you find this stuff?
I used to spend too much time on eBay.
Clearly.
Ages 3 to 8 years. It's actually quite amusing to think of the children, like what they're learning. Like, this is the future, child.
Yes, at age 3. Play with this model of a UNIVAC at age 3.
This will make you obsolete by the time you grow up. But
yeah.
Don't fear it.
I think this honestly, though, it's funny, we're joking about that, but there was a genuine parental anxiety about this stuff. Like, everyone knew computers were coming and it was going to revolutionize the world, but no one knew exactly what that was going to look like. And so, like, our parents of that generation were just hurling everything at us to just desperately hope that their kids didn't get left behind, whatever this future was going to be. So you think about the toys like this and the computer camps and the basic classes in schools and stuff that, you know, and the computers that, you know, parents who didn't understand them bought them anyway and just threw them at their kids, hoping or trusting that this was somehow going to be good for them. But I think there was probably a lot of anxiety around that for raising a kid in that period.
There was genuine anxiety, but if it's hard to think about what that felt like back then from a retro perspective, just think about how people are feeling about AI right now.
And yeah.
There's a really solid analogy there. Like, yeah. It almost feels like an existential risk sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. A parallel. Yeah, AI is a good one. I was thinking maybe social media, but social media feels more like we're all pretty clear it's probably a net negative at this point. So like, if you just want to, that's almost more like alcohol. Like, you let your kids sort of expose them to it, but you have to teach them how to manage it. But AI is a good analogy because it's like, okay, that's clearly got upsides and it's clearly going to change everything. But yeah, in scary ways that we don't understand yet. So yeah, that's a good one. I like that.
All right. Now I guess we can move to the items of interest and news. Earl, you have the first one.
I do?
You do.
And
somewhere I have
I do.
Here we go.
I think it's about the grease weasel.
It is.
So Peter had sent us an email. Thank you. And the email was in the "in case you haven't seen it" category of things. And this grease weasel was one of the items that he mentioned. I don't know if the version 4 is freshly out or if it's been around a little while, but there were a couple of things that I really appreciated learning about this. One is, well, first off, let me try and explain what a grease weasel is. It is a card that will connect, I think, with USB to your standard Windows, Mac, Linux computer. And then the other side of it is an interface that lets you connect to old floppy drives, 5 1/4 inch, 8 inch, perhaps 3.5 inch. I think as long as it meets the Shugart interfacing style, then you can connect to it. And you can use this to make very high fidelity archives of diskettes, pretty much irrespective of the original recording format. You know, everybody had a different format. Apple, Commodore, Atari, they all had a different way of putting the information on the diskette. And this grease weasel is capturing the magnetic flux, if I understand it right. It's capturing it at a lower level than that. So you can use these to archive things that you might not even have a computer for. It can take the diskette and make a pure image of it. And then later on, I think that you can take that image and analyze it or even write it back with this grease weasel, if I understand the technology. I don't have one of these, but I know that it's pretty heavily used in the disk archiving world. You guys correct me if I got any of that wrong.
Yeah, sounds right. I'm not familiar with this device. How does it? Does anyone know how it compares to like a CryoFlux? Like, is it similar?
I think it's similar. There are a number of products like this. I might have a grease weasel, but I know I haven't used it, and I don't have a V4. But I think it is doing the same sort of thing. I think they're all doing the same sort of thing, which is sampling the drive at a very high rate.
Right.
Okay. Can you read what that first paragraph says?
It says, Grease Weasel allows versatile floppy drive control over USB. Read and write your vintage floppy disks from your PC, Linux, Mac computer. This USB device lets you connect an old floppy disk drive to your modern computer to read-write floppy disks from any system with Shugart standard drives. So that's Amiga, Atari, Commodore, Amstrad, Sinclair, PC, CNC machines, musical instruments, industrial equipment, and more. So anything with that interface. Oops. Yeah.
I suppose it's worth distinguishing devices like this from the Applesauce, which is a device that does this, but also includes a sort of a dynamic file format, because there is a type of disk information that can't be captured with devices like this, which I think is a common misconception with non-Apple people. It's a common misconception that if you just capture the flux, that's the best possible capture of a disk, and therefore that's all we need to do. But of course, with the very elaborate copy protection that Apple II games engaged in, there's a lot of like non-information that has to be captured. So things like weak bits, random data that is supposed to be different every time you look at it, that kind of thing, that these devices can't capture because they are taking a state of the disk and cementing it permanently, which will actually not work with a lot of Apple II copy protection.
Interesting.
So the Applesauce, what makes it different is it layers on top of that flux capture, it layers the WAS file format, which is a dynamic file format that can effectively simulate random weak bits that, you know, read differently every time you read the sector, that kind of thing, which is a common tool that's leveraged by copy protection.
Copy protection is just devious.
Yeah,
it is. Particularly on the Apple II. I mean, someone needs to write a book about it someday, because the non-Apple II retro world tends not to appreciate how crazy it was in the Apple II world.
And we have confirmation in the chat from John and Andrew that this grease weasel device is in the same category as something like a CryoFlux SuperCard Pro or the Applesauce that you're talking about here. The preference seems to be for the grease weasel because it's actively maintained and open, and I'd heard good things about them. Mm-hmm. So I was just surprised at the price. I didn't think that they were as inexpensive as they are, like in the $30 to $40 range, US dollars.
Yeah, it's very inexpensive. Yeah, and I think the CryoFlux has fallen out of favor a little bit because I think it hasn't been maintained, and I think they closed it. Like, it was an open community project, I think, for a while, and then someone bought it or something, and they closed it down, and apparently there's been some drama around the CryoFlux that I think maybe has soured people on it. So this grease weasel seems like a good alternative.
Well, I thank Peter for sending this in, and I think, Peter, you accidentally cost me $30 or $40 because I'm going to get one of these things for myself. And I just find this whole archiving, you know, you'd think that in 2024, we would have finally archived everything, but it's not true. There are still disks that come up out there, and it has software on there that's a piece of history that somebody archives, and it would have been lost to the annals of time. I had one just a couple of years ago with the Altair that I think I talked about on the show, that I had a version of CPM for a high-density disk controller that I have that seems to be really rare for the Altair, and those disks weren't anywhere. They weren't archived, and now they are, which was fun. And I actually I had quite a bit of fun participating in that little bit of archiving there. I don't know that it'll make a huge dent, obviously, in the history of mankind, but there's some bits that were important to some people at some time that are now on the internet that weren't before. So.
Yeah, well, and as any archivist will say, we can't know what's going to be important. So 200, 500 years from now, someone might want to look back and they might learn something about looking at those high-density Altair disks that couldn't have been learned about, you know, civilization today any other way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no way to know what information might be useful to the future. What's neat about this Grease Weasel is they specifically call out non-computing, non-general purpose computer disk drives, which I think is a really unappreciated segment as far as archiving goes. You know, we've talked a lot on the show about in the past about weird synthesizer floppy disk formats and court stenographer floppy disks and those single-purpose word processor machines that had little floppy drives in them. All of those machines had some weird proprietary format that capturing them at the flux level like this thing would be the only way to probably to archive those disks. So that definitely seems like a really awesome thing. Like there's probably a whole world of 8-bit synthesizer floppies out there that someone needs to archive. And this device might be the only way to do it.
And Buried Bits just mentioned in the chat, this was a interesting point too. I'd forgotten about this, that a really old version of DOS, one of the early like primordial versions from Seattle Computer Products, was recently unearthed, which was interesting because you could actually see, if I remember right, the pivot of this from the CPM that it was kind of sort of derived from into the 8086 version that it was. And there was a whole write-up about that. I should have actually probably remembered to make that a news item. Maybe we can talk about it next time.
Oh, interesting. So it's so it really is like very recent news. I missed it. If so,
it's pretty recent. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. I did want to talk a little bit about the applesauce. That is, unfortunately, the hardware is not gettable right now. I expect that it will become gettable again, but the software has been advancing, and the software for the applesauce is actually quite amazing. So even if you captured the flux with a SuperCard Pro or a Grease Weasel or something, I think applesauce can handle that and turn it into something that it can process. But the software itself does a lot of Quinn was mentioning these weak bits, the like things on the disk that just don't read the same every time, and some software would actually look for that, you know. So if it said the same thing every time you read it, then it was clearly a copy because it got frozen in time. But what this program does is, you know, takes a flux and sort of looks at it, multiple reads of every track, and tries to figure out like what's changing and what's not changing. And it is a harder problem than it sounds like, because the tracks don't always have the same number of bits every time around.
Yeah, and there was even tricks you could do with the analog gain on the Apple II disk controller. So as soon as you're talking about analog gain, anything analog in the system, it's going to vary read to read. It's going to vary disk to disk. And if you don't capture all of that behavior, there's going to be some copy protected Apple II game that isn't archivable. Mm-hmm.
And actually the frustrating thing is that even if you ran this with a flux, some sort of flux device that you thought captured the disk, and then you lost the disk, you haven't captured the disk. You have missed something, and so that's mm-hmm. always the fear. But the applesauce, maybe I don't know, a couple of years ago, really started branching out. So even with an Apple II drive, you can read a number of like Atari and Commodore disks. A lot of times you have to use third party drives that have sort of a wider range of track movement. But it also has other connections on the back that lets you plug into like standard PC drives, like the Grease Weasel plugs into, or I think even like an 8-inch drive. And he's got stuff in there that will recognize North Star disks and TI disks and Victor 9000 disks, and sort of attempt to show you what's on the disk, verify the contents. You know, if you need to read it again, it'll try to tell you that, you know, we've got a bad sector here and stuff. So definitely, even if you don't have the device, the software's free and worth looking at, because it can do conversion and analysis even of the flux images from other things.
That's amazing. I didn't actually know it had developed that widely. It's sort of the Fuji net of disk capture devices. Mm. Like, it's handling everything now. Amiga and Commodore and Atari and all kinds of stuff.
Victor 9000 was tricky, because didn't they use some like real interesting floppy controller tricks to get very high density on those diskettes? I thought I remember Chuck Peddle having something to do with that. I could be misremembering, but I thought that it was a very innovative thing that didn't actually take off, but
I don't know that I ever knew that, but so you might well be correct. Probably you are.
So it's interesting also that he's doing the early Mac stuff now as well, which the early Mac stuff had a constant linear velocity floppy drive mm-hmm. in them. So that's, again, physically different enough than other floppy disks of the time that it makes those disks difficult to archive. So they would put more data in outer track sectors than inner ones, because there's physically more space in the same sector of an outer track. So that's why Mac disks were 800K and PC ones were 744K or whatever. That's why, it's because they had that constant linear velocity as opposed to constant radial velocity drive, which was not easy to capture, I'm sure.
And actually, I am pretty sure that there's some stuff that's not listed in here, because I've forgotten the name of it now, but I have a really weird old computer that he's added the file format for. I'll have to figure this out. But it was an old 6502 computer, very, very good graphics. They made very few of them. It was an abbreviation like MTI or something like that. But someone out there has a setup and found disks and has been working with John, the applesauce guy, to put this together. And so now it recognizes these disks, even though there are probably nine out there, all together. Buried Bits in the chat asks, can't you just DD or DD rescue to do a low-level capture bit for bit and load the data via FujiNet? And I think that's in a sense, it always feels like you should be able to. And the thing is that things do rely on the variation, that if you just do a DD rescue, well, I guess if it finds something that's varying, it's going to say, I just can't read this. Every time I read it, it's coming up different. So this must be a bad sector.
Yeah, the applesauce is kind of an amazing device, because it sort of had to come out of the Apple II community, at the risk of sounding self-important, because to truly be able to capture an archive software in its original copy-protected form without some bad teenager's dirty jokes in a crack screen on the front of it, you have to understand Apple II copy protection at an incredibly deep level. So this device really came out of a collaboration between John Morris and 4AM and a lot of other people in the Apple II community who kind of came together to make this happen, because so much domain knowledge was required. And then once you can archive successfully all the Apple II stuff, all the other platforms are, sorry to sound snobbish, easy, because everything else is sort of a subset of what the Apple II is doing in terms of copy protection and manipulating the Shugart disk mechanism to make it do weird tricks. So if you can solve the Apple II, everything else is solvable.
Mm-hmm. Well, because didn't Apple get the Shugart drive mechanisms from Shugart, but they didn't get the controller? They put their own controller on there, and Woz did his own design, which made it really flexible. But it sounds like that flexibility also gave the copy protection people more ammunition to work with in terms of what they were doing. Non-deterministic bits, that's just crazy. I'd never heard of anything like that before, and I'm surprised that it even worked, and more surprised that they used it in a commercial aspect. That's impressive.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, the Shugart mechanism, or the Shugart drive controller board, was enormous. Like, it was this giant board with 65 TTL chips on it, and Apple didn't want to pay for that because it was going to make the drive too expensive to sell. So their solution was to lock Woz in a room for 6 months, and he developed the Disk II controller board, which basically what it did was it offloaded most of what the Shugart board was doing onto the CPU. So it's the Disk 2 controller is a pretty thin interface to the physical mechanism, but the CPU in the Apple II has pretty much total control over the drive head and the disk motor, and to the point where you can like mess with the analog gain on the magnetic read head and so on by, you know, how long you wait to read bits, and there's all kinds of like how many zeros you put in a row and so on. So yeah, it gets pretty elaborate. So yeah, of course, immediately the copy protection people jumped all over that to do all kinds of dark magic.
Well, another thing that they do, I don't know to what extent the Shugart board could do this, but the stepper motor, it's just, I remember being very surprised as a kid, realizing that all you're doing is like you're turning on and off four different magnets. You know, I mean, and if you do it, if you give this thing some spin, it'll just keep like going around and around. You just have the magnets chase it around. And that's how you move it from track to track. But you can also like turn on two magnets at once and have it hover in the middle. And, you know, so you could use these half track or quarter tracks, they were actually.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even spiral tracking, which also came along at one point. And the other thing about the Apple II drive is that it was soft sectored. So a lot of early floppy drive systems were hard sectored. There was a physical hole punched in the disk. And so that was marked sector zero or zero on the disk each time it came around. Whereas the Apple II was soft sectored. So you actually had to read the flux on the disk to know where you were on the circle of sectors. And that also allowed a lot of weird tricks. You could mess with the little markers that the disk controller was expecting to mark the start and finish of a sector. Soft sectoring was a whole other avenue of manipulation, basically.
There was a pretty cool project that Forrest at Kansas Fest did at one point, which was related to this. That because when you boot an Apple II floppy, it's looking for the first sector, and if you put two first sectors on, then it will boot differently depending on sort of like which one happens to hit the read write head first. So he had a disk that would boot into several different, you know, possible configurations.
That's funny.
It was like his metaphor for it was two vinyl records with different spirals interleaved on it. So depending on where you happen to put the needle down, it would play a different record effectively. But each record was half as long because they both have to fit in the same space. But yeah, it would randomly boot a different disk depending on where the disk happened to be, so that which of the soft sectors the head hit first when it spun up. Super interesting and clever.
Yeah, I think there was a he said something about this, that, like, there was a Monty Python record, or there was some sort of physical record on a record player that would do this, that had sort of
interesting. I didn't know that.
Non-deterministic endings.
That's a great idea for a comedy record, actually. Mm. That sounds like something Monty Python would do.
All right. So that's Earl's newest item about the grease weasel.
Yeah, that generated a lot more conversation than
I
thought it would.
That's good. That was good.
That is awesome.
Am I next? I think I'm next, yeah. This weird project showed up. Just as we were recording, I don't know how old this is. 6 hours ago, it says the history is on GitHub. So this is a Apple II pendulum clock. Has anyone seen this prior to just now? Okay.
No.
I thought it was kind of a neat idea. It is essentially someone has made a clock for an Apple II clone. So the idea is basically, you know, do you want to just sort of like keep time. And in order to do that, you need some sort of oscillation source, you know, so that you can sort of count them and you know, keep track. And so what this person did, this is actually, I don't know the person's name, but WKJAGT on GitHub, realized that, you know, there's a perfect oscillation source right behind the computer, which was a clock with a pendulum. and it has sort of a nostalgic connection. He said, since this is my grandparents' clock, the one I grew up knowing and hearing tick as a kid, I really didn't want to modify it in any way. So I wanted to use the clock as the source. And so what this person did was found a way to, there's a proximity sensor here somewhere. So that essentially when the pendulum swings by a certain point, and it will like trigger something that will send an IRQ to the processor. And it has a possible AppleSauce connection, actually. in that I think that's the applesauce has a thing that you install in order to get a really accurate read on like where you are in the track. And I think it might be the same thing, actually.
If you were scrolling around there, it said something like an inductance sensor.
Yeah.
Yeah, which would make sense because that would sense the mass of the pendulum. An inductive sensor can sense a large metallic object, which would save him having to modify the clock in any way. Like he wouldn't have to install a laser, you know, sensor inside the clock or anything.
Ah, I see. Okay, so maybe this isn't quite the same. The applesauce thing is one of there's like a little magnet on the wheel, and then it runs by this. I think it was called a Hall effect sensor. I don't know if that's related or not, but
yeah. So Hall effect sensors detect magnets, basically. Yeah.
But anyway, back to the pendulum clock. Mainly, I just thought it was kind of cool, the idea that you would connect up a physical pendulum, which is in a timekeeping piece that's been, you know.
It's going to be kind of low resolution. You could use the software equivalent of a phase lock loop to mm-hmm. try to get a higher, you know, tick count
right.
if you wanted to. But, some of those old clocks maintain amazingly accurate time mm-hmm. with their big old pendulums. So that's hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah, pendulums are very accurate. Really, the only thing that lets them down is usually the escapement mechanism in the clock is where the inaccuracy is introduced. But the actual physics of a pendulum are basically perfect for timekeeping. Not counting losses in the pinch point and so on, of mm-hmm. course. So what does he then do with this IRQ? So he's just got a clock running on the Apple II, like a wall clock program that he's written? Is that?
It does appear that he's got just sort of a clock program running. So it's not keeping your VisiCalc documents, you know, in the right time, but he does have this the clock behind it, and he's got a video showing the pendulum actually going.
Oh, and you can see the little sensor.
Yeah.
He's got an LED blinking every time the pendulum swings by it.
Yeah. So very cool. Okay, let's see. Quinn, did you have a news item?
I do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so regular listeners will know one of my favorite type of projects is homebrew computers. And so this is one that came across my feed from a fellow named Eric Badger. And on the stream here, we have a video of it that I'll scrub through and show you some highlights. But so what I love about this is that this project could be possibly called Chips to Load Runner because he starts with building a breadboard 6502 based computer, as many of us do, and he ends up with something that plays Load Runner, which is a pretty amazing journey. And the other thing I love about this is that it's very it's very brand agnostic, let's say. He actually brings in a lot of stuff from different retro computers to make this work. So he starts with a Ben Eater 6502 breadboard computer kit, which is a good excuse to talk about Ben Eater's kits because they're awesome. So he has a kit where you can build a 6502 computer on a breadboard, and what you end up with is the most minimal 6502 computer that everyone builds to start with, which has RAM and a little bit of ROM and a little LCD display and a serial port, and you can just kind of watch it execute code and display memory addresses or whatever, but that's all it'll do. So he starts with that. And then he upgrades it with a more modern interface chip. So as many people probably know, you can still buy 6502s from Western Design Center, and they have more modern interface chips that you can connect to it, more modern than the 6551. Was that the chip that gave you sort of basic I/O on the 6502? There are more modern versions of that chip that give you more sophisticated I/O, and he used that to get serial port going, and from there he actually brought in WASA's monitor from the Apple II. So there's a block of code called WASMON, which is a 256 byte block, which basically implements WASA's raw monitor in a very, very compact way. So that allows you to display memory and read and write memory over the serial port. So that's super useful. And then from there he added BASIC, and so BASIC For that, he went to, well, just a little side quest into video here, but for the BASIC, he went to Microsoft BASIC, and he ended up implementing what is ultimately a version of the PET BASIC that seemed to be the easiest one to port in his efforts. So he gets PET BASIC in there, and from there he wants to get Load Runner working. So there's a bunch of stuff about trying to get video going. And as anyone who's ever built a retro computer knows, getting video going is, of course, the most difficult part. So there's a lot of conversation in this video about the challenges of getting the CPU and the video scanner to talk to the same memory at the same time. That's certainly the thing that derailed me on my homebrew computer for a couple of years, actually, was figuring out good ways to do that. It turns out to be quite difficult. So he battles with that. And when it comes time to finally port Load Runner, again, he goes through and looks at all of the different implementations of Load Runner. It existed on many, many platforms. And he ends up landing on a Cocoa 3 port of it. Someone ported the original Apple II Load Runner to the Cocoa 3 and had all of the source code for that. And so he ported, he started with the Cocoa 3 6502 port and ported it to his machine, and does eventually get it running. And anyway, so it's a great story. The video that we'll have in the show notes is a very high-level overview of it. There's not a ton of detail in here. It's just like I did this, and then I did this, and then I did this, with a lot of photos and so on. So it's a fun, quick watch. But then if you want more info, he does have the links in the description for all of his KiCad files for his video circuitry, and all of the different things that he went through is all documented with links from there. So the video is a good starting point if you want to know a lot more detail about this project. So pretty awesome to go from chips on a breadboard to playing Load Runner on a homebrew computer. That's pretty
wild. Wow. That is pretty wild. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's as someone who's taken this journey and did not get nearly this far, I can say bravo, Mr. Badger, because that's quite something. Oh, and I also love that it was a pandemic lockdown project also. So This was how he filled his time with during COVID lockdown. So always nice to see what came out of that.
The silver lining projects.
Yeah, exactly. So I will stop sharing that. But yeah, strong recommend for that video. If you're interested in building a homebrew computer, I think this video, like, spend 9 minutes watching this video and you will get a very good feel for what you're going to have to go through to build a homebrew computer. Like, the hard stuff is not the stuff you think is going to be hard, and the easy stuff is not what you think is going to be easy, I guess. So it's very much worth seeing this, because you'll see, like, 10 seconds of the video is devoted to connecting a 6502 to some RAM and getting it to run code. Like, that sounds like it's going to be hard, but that part's super easy. And then, like, 6 minutes of the video is devoted to trying to get the CPU and the video scanner to read the same memory, which, scale that up to 5 years, and that's the amount of that percentage of time is correct. Like, you will spend 3 of your 5 years, you know, trying to solve that problem or looking at how other people do it. Don't try to solve it yourself like I did. Look at other people's solutions to save yourself a couple of years. It's a good overview of what you're in for if you really want to do this. And it's also worth noting there's no operating system here, so he's just running Load Runner from ROM, basically. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of skipped that step. A lot of people go to the operating system and then to writing a compiler and then to porting code on their own compiler and so on. But if you just want to play a game, you can just put it in ROM and go from there.
I tried to do that journey, but not with physical hardware. I tried to do it with an FPGA, taking a 6502 core, getting some RAM hooked up to it, and making it run first a free run, which worked, and then actually making it run some code and getting some validation that it ran the code. And I also got stuck at the video section, because doing the video, you have to spit out the video to something. In this case, I was trying to spit out to a VGA, which that part turned out to be not so tough, trying to figure out the VGA analog standard, because that's not that hard, getting the timing. Yeah. The hard part was, I think, what you just mentioned, dual porting the RAM so that the CPU and that could talk to it, and the video processing could talk to it, and they wouldn't bump into each other. And that's where I got stuck. And I need to get back to that, because that'd be fun. I also want to throw out another shout out for Ben Eater's videos. They're fun to watch, and he almost got me into building a breadboarded 6502, because I started with breadboards. that's how I started in the whole electronics thing, was with solderless breadboards. But I just felt like I could never match Ben Eater's precision with his wires. Have you seen any of his videos? Because he makes the breadboard look beautiful. It looks better than a printed circuit board, actually. It's just, whereas anytime I breadboard something, it just looks like chaos. It looks like a wire factory exploded on top of my breadboard. Whereas his stuff looks gorgeous. So I don't know if I have that level of patience, but he's amazing.
Yeah, that's something I got better at over the years when I was developing my computer was, you get better at getting the wires to be the exact right length so they'll sit flat and in nice rows on top of the breadboard. And it's helpful because it's much, much easier to understand what you're looking at. You know, when you're trying to debug the thing and you've got a giant rat's nest of wires on top of the breadboard, it's very difficult to trace things out and figure out what's wrong with your setup. And it's also very easy to bump wires and knock them out if it's not tidy. So it's definitely advantageous to have it be tidy. The whole video scanning memory thing. So I chuckled at one part in that video. He mentions dual port RAM, which is how I ended up solving that problem on my computer. I basically threw in the towel and found out dual port RAM is a thing that you can buy, which is specifically designed to have two completely different systems touch the same RAM, and it manages that negotiation for you. They're fairly expensive, and he comments that he didn't want to, he felt like dual port RAM was too expensive and it was quitter talk, so he didn't go down that route. And so I laughed. I was like, yeah, I gave up and went to dual port RAM. I was so excited, though, when I found out dual port RAM exists, because it was a magic bullet to solve the problem, basically. You know, compared to, say, what Woz did on the Apple II, which was a vastly more elegant solution. You know, he used the off phase of the clock where the 6502 is not accessing memory to then scan the video memory and also magically update the DRAM at the same time. So he was basically doing three things at once, all sort of interleaved in a very clever way. But that video is quite a good watch, I would say.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of the Ben Eater shop and kits before, but it's very intriguing. Because what I need is another project.
Yeah, if you're trying to avoid buying projects, don't go there, because he's got a lot of really great ones.
Perhaps I will make it into a gift idea in the future if it hasn't already.
Yeah, and like Earl said, his videos are great if you want to learn about homebrew computer development, because he has videos on most topics that you're going to encounter. So, for example, as soon as you need a keyboard, everybody goes through this process where, okay, I have to talk to a keyboard. How do I do that? And pretty much everybody lands on PS2 keyboards because they're quite easy to talk to and they're actually backward compatible through USB. So if you get the right USB keyboard that has the PS2 backward compatibility built into it, which most of them do, then you can talk to it. So Ben Eater has a video on here's how you bitbang PS2 protocol through a 6502. Which will save you a lot of time if you're trying to physically talk to a PS2 keyboard on your homebrew computer. The other thing people do nowadays, especially, is they start just throwing Raspberry Pis at it, which Eric does a little bit in his videos. You can, now that Raspberry Pis are so fast, you can throw them in there to do your video for you, or throw it in there to act as your keyboard interface or whatever. So that's also an option, but... Yeah, it's always interesting to see all the different solutions to these problems. And Ben Eater's videos are a great primer on all these different little pieces that you're going to have to solve.
By the way, I did come up with that computer that I couldn't remember. So it is the MTU-130. This is a 6502-based thing that it had very good graphics. And there are very few of them out there. I think the company is presently like a karaoke machine creator of some kind, but there are a few of these things out there. They were sort of specialized, and the applesauce can read these discs, as I understand it. So, I have one, and this is all it does, which means I think probably that the CPU is not. At first, I thought the CPU wasn't running. So what we're seeing is a screen that has just a bunch of vertical bars, but yet a bunch of sort of static looking pixels occasionally on, and I think actually once the manual was unearthed, it was determined that this is, in fact, the expected thing it does if the disk drive is not connected.
Oh.
So that's kind of nice in a way. The other thing that's funny about the disk drive on this is that it runs all the time. It does not turn on and off. It is just always on.
Really? Like the motor is always spinning?
Yeah, which I guess makes it fast.
But noisy, and I guess would wear it out. I would think that would be hard on the disk that you have in there, because the disk is just going to be physically spinning in there all the time inside of its little sleeve.
I guess.
It seems like one of the Amigas was like that. 500 or the 600 or something like that. I thought that the disk was just always running unless you did something special to turn it off.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, Blake has talked about that, because when I briefly considered buying an Amiga, Blake told me there's some plug-in thing you have to get, like a driver or something that you can install that will actually stop the drive when you're not using it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was something like, we'll get emails, we're getting this wrong in some way, but yeah, there is something like that on the Amiga where it doesn't, where it spins the disk all the time in weird ways. Yeah.
Anyway, I really want to get, I want to do something with that MTU thing, but, cause I got it actually relatively cheaply. It was just, nobody knew what it was. It just looked like a thing.
I feel like to the RCR bingo card, we have to add, learned about a new computer that I didn't know existed.
Right.
Because that's
yes,
this one.
Yes, me too.
Literally every single recording, I learn about some new computer that I didn't know existed.
All right. Let's see. I think, what was I about to do? I think I was about to go to a word from our sponsor, which I guess I just did.
And here's a word from our sponsor.
That's an excellent radio voice.
Here's another Radio Shack major computer breakthrough. The amazing new TRS-80 pocket computer, only $249. Imagine a basic language computer that weighs just 6 ounces. Now carry TRS-80 power in your pocket while traveling, on the job, solve problems, process data, and store it in permanent memory for instant recall. The amazing TRS-80 pocket computer, only at Radio Shack, the biggest name in little computers. Commodore, a Texas Instruments, an IBM, or an Apple, you can play the most famous arcade games ever invented. The original arcade hits from AtariSoft. Donkey Kong, Centipede, Pac-Man, Defender, Robotron, Stargate, and Dig Dug. Now your computer fits the arcade hits from AtariSoft.
AtariSoft,
AtariSoft,
now your computer fits the arcade hits.
Some games available on ColecoVision and in television.
And we're back.
Perfect. So, the host's retro competing gift idea this time is a movie, a documentary movie by one David Grealish called Before Macintosh, The Apple Lisa.
I've heard of him.
Yeah.
Didn't he actually start this podcast or something?
He, in fact, did. So, David's been working for a long time, actually, on this documentary that is basically about the Apple Lisa and its place sort of before the Mac, right? So, how it sort of came to be and then came to not be, and how the Mac sort of followed. So, it's available on Vimeo as a like rent or buy kind of an option. It's a $13 buy on Vimeo. And as I understand it, he's also going to be making physical DVDs if you are one who would prefer to have a physical DVD. I have not finished watching it yet, but I have watched a fair amount of it and scrubbed through a fair amount of the other. And he's got some really interesting people there that he's talking to. He's talking to John Couch and John Sculley, you know, big deal names from Apple. He's talking to some people who are sort of collectors. He talks to John Woodall, who is Vintage Micros and one of the big sort of Lisa dealers, and Bob Cook, who was the Sun Remarketing guy, who keeps coming up. It was his leases that got smashed in the Logan landfill. So anyway, yeah, David got a chance to talk to a lot of people, and he sunk a lot of work and pain into this, I'm sure. But it's great that it's actually out there, and it's not too expensive. So if you're if you're actually buying a gift for someone else, consider it. Otherwise, you're probably buying it for yourself, but it's worth it, I think. And
I'm buying it for myself in about 30 minutes.
Yeah, ditto. This is amazing. I didn't know. I knew he was working on this. I didn't know it was out. So I will be watching this tonight for sure. This is fantastic.
Yeah. And maybe we'll even have him come talk about it at some point. But right now he's probably taking a nap.
I mean, everything I've heard is that making something on this scale is a labor of love. So much effort goes into it.
It took longer than he expected, but he, in the last section, sprinted to try to get it released on the anniversary of the Max introduction. So he did, and he did succeed at that. I think that's January 24th.
Okay. So this is breaking news.
Yeah.
This just came out 4 days ago. Okay. Yeah. As we record anyway. Awesome.
Yeah. All right. And so when you're done buying the documentary and watching it, we can turn to, I guess, eBay auctions. And Earl, you have the first of these.
I just have one. This is a Commodore 1581 3D printed case. Most of the eBay auctions I add in to the show are things that I would actually purchase myself. I don't know that I would buy this. I'm just fascinated by this. It is a, as I mentioned, it looks just like a 1581 case, except it's in black plastic. As you look through the photographs, there are some blemishes. There's some things that are typical of the precision that you get with 3D printing, which is to say pretty good, but not perfect. The thing that I find really fascinating is in the description, the seller notes that this was for a project that didn't materialize, and now they're selling it at a reasonable price, which I think is true. It's going for $35 US. The thing is, I'm really fascinated in what that project was. Mm-hmm. I know that I've had a lot of computing projects that I bought some things for and then, you know, didn't wind up coming to fruition, and I would use the items for something else. But ultimately, what are you going to use a 1581 case for, except for a 1581? Which, by the way, for those who might not be as familiar with Commodore, was their 3.5-inch external disk drive. So I was just really interested, where did this come from? What was it going to be used for?
What is your story, drive?
Yeah.
And now it's not going to be used for that. And I almost feel like buying it just because I want a piece of this history that never was. But I guess the other thing is, if you have a 1581 that works, but the case is horrifically banged up, then this might be an interesting conversation piece for you. So that's my pick.
I'm pleased to own a 1571 drive for my Commodore. It came with one, and that is quite a nice drive. It's quite a bit more pleasant to use than the original gigantic 1541s.
Oh, yeah. And the 1571 is so versatile. If you ever get a 128 and get into running CPM or that, you can read a bunch of different CPM formats. And the 1571 was so versatile, it could do just about, it could even read and write DOS diskettes. So,
that's cool.
They're quite cool.
Yeah, and it's got you can only access it if you have it connected to a 128, but it has DOS utilities in ROM on the drive. So, there's a program launcher and stuff built into the drive, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, Commodore made some neat drive technology. It's a shame that at the last minute, with the 1541, that they had to go out with a drive where the interface was so slow that it's it's baked into retro computing lore how slow the 1541 was and how people use different tricks to overcome that. But the 1571 with a 128 has what they call burst mode, which is much, much faster. I think like a 5x increase.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's only twice as slow as the Apple II.
We joke that there are people who are still loading their game. 2024.
All right, let's see. I you know, as usual, just grabbed a bunch of things. The first in the notes I put Terrible Mouse, but this there's it's sort of timely for the Lisa documentary. There's a Lisa Mouse up for sale. I don't know what it started at. It probably started at 100, but it's currently at $103, and it has 4 days to go. I think it's going to probably go for a fair amount because these are they are terrible. I believe for everybody I've heard talking about using them say, you know, they're bad as mice, but they are also very rare, and they came with the first Lisas. So if you see them, they have a sort of a rectangular, they're much boxier than later mice and have a very narrow.
Yeah, it's kind of an ugly thing, honestly. I mean, most Apple mice from this period were kind of attractive, but not that thing.
The original Mac 128 mouse kind of boxy too. What's that, the O100?
Yeah, the MO100. The, in quotation marks, yeah. MO100, because there are a million of them under that number.
That model number turned out to represent about 20 different mice, which is sort of funny.
But yeah, I think this looks a little bit like it, except that the button got bigger and didn't. I don't think it went up as high. It was the same color. Not always. I guess they did have different color schemes, but it just looked better. It looked more streamlined.
Yeah, the proportions were better. The proportions on this thing are off. It's off. Yeah, it's an off-putting position and size for that button. I don't know. This is a silly argument, I guess, to have, but yeah, it's ugly.
I mean, I guess it had no prior thing to compare it to, but they used this to make better ones later.
Yeah. Yes, it's certainly more attractive than Douglas Engelbart's prototype, I guess. Yeah. If that was their only basis for comparison.
Right. What else do I have? Oh, yeah, this I don't know, maybe it's possibly in the same category of terrible controller, but I don't actually have any experience with this. This is a Atari Soft Track and Field. So Atari, I don't know. I think it was maybe a little bit late in the game, but somehow they created a number of their own titles for the Apple II and other platforms. I think that Atari Soft had these for Atari and a lot of other platforms. The Apple ones were in the red boxes, but I think the colors were different for the others. At any rate, they're actually pretty easy to find because they made too many and nobody wanted to buy them. So
many. Yeah. In the past episodes, we've shown eBay listings where people are selling pallets of Atari Soft games. Like if you want a pallet of Dig Dugs. Right. They made so many of these things.
It's kind of fun because you can open them, right? I mean, like without any the feelings of without feeling bad at all, you can just take off that shrink wrap. The only one that I think was a little bit distinguished was this Track and Field one, because this actually came with a controller. So unlike all the other ones, which was just sort of like a piece of paper and a disc that, you know, didn't even look very professional inside a box that would collapse immediately if you looked at it wrong. This one actually came with a controller to use for Track and Field, which, you know, I guess, you know, this is to make your little person run. I don't even know if I played this, to be honest. Quinn, do you have any experience with this or Earl, like this game?
No, I never played the Apple II version. I played the arcade version quite a bit. The arcade version is quite notorious because people have a lot of different... So the way the controls work is there's two buttons, and one button moves your left foot forward, and the other button moves the right foot forward. And the speed and consistency with which you alternate those buttons is how fast you go. So you have to be fast, but also smooth and consistent. So the time delay between pushing one button or the other has to be consistent. And it's the same control scheme, actually, that Microsoft used in Olympic Decathlon.
Okay.
And if for Track and Field, there's all manner of techniques people have, like just a common one involving a pencil, where you hold a pencil between your fingers and you hit one button or the other with the other each end of the pencil. So in the arcade, you would see people doing that. So anyway, there was various tricks like that for this sort of infamous control scheme. But similarly, infamously, these buttons did not last long because teenagers hammering on them as quickly as they can for hours on end, there's no button that can survive that.
I guess maybe it's a little better to get the dedicated controller than to lose, you know, two keys on your keyboard.
Yeah, this actually makes a kind of sense, because I knew people who were not allowed to play Olympic Decathlon on their Apple IIs because their parents were wisely concerned that the 1 and 2 key, or the colon and semicolon key, which were the two players, would be worn out by that game, which is a valid concern.
Yeah. Anyway, so this is mainly I'm just pointing this out to point out the existence of the track and field, you know, the Atari Soft track and field that came with the controller. Given the recent history of the way this podcast winds up on the feed, all things that we talk about, the auctions will be over by the time you're listening to this. But that's okay. They're interesting things anyway. So the next one I have is a Lisa Draw Art Department Master and Dealer demo disc. There was a program on the Lisa called Lisa Draw, and this is like clip art for it. And that's got to be unbelievably rare.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's on Twiggy discs. I don't know if we can zoom in on this.
Oh, wow, look at that. Yeah, holy cow. Those discs are always so strange looking.
Yeah.
To bring it back full circle, these Twiggy discs, they look like a disc designed by an AI.
Yes, like exactly.
If you asked Midjourney to make a floppy disk, this is what it would come up with.
Yeah, it's got disk windows on both sides. It's got like three different notches. One of them is going through.
Yeah. There's a through hole, and then a notch on one corner, and then a notch on one side, and then two little notches at the base.
Yes.
And two windows. Oh my goodness, it's crazy.
Kind of like a modern smartphone. I don't know where to hold it.
I was just going to say, where do you hold this thing? I'm scared to touch it because every part of it is sensitive in some way.
I think the place you hold it is in, if we're looking at this, where the label is, you hold it under the right side of the label.
Okay.
In fact, I think actually underneath it, you can see a little dot that is indicating, you know, hold here.
Ah, okay. And nowhere else.
Yeah. But, yeah. Anyway, I've never seen this before. there are very few people out there who actually have Twiggy drives that could read this. But
yeah, those drives are very rare.
Yeah,
I have to say it's a little bit insulting to name your clip art disc art department.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of graphic artists who work hard at companies who would not be appreciating that characterization.
About as happy as they are right now with Midjourney.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we don't need an art department. We have this clip art disc named art department.
There's a little sticker on it that says Lisa Fileware, because that's sort of the name that they used for these Twiggy discs, and they have a little icon of a Twiggy disc. I love many things about this.
Well, and those windows would be on both sides, right? So this actually has four read-write windows on this disc. Because the Twiggy discs, they wrote to both sides at the same time, right? So you didn't have to flip them over.
Yeah.
So that actually has four access points to the media. Wow, crazy.
Yeah, although I think they did, I think that the top and the bottom were being read on separate sides.
Ah, okay. All right, that's interesting. Some I guess kind that of makes sense. Yeah, you want the pressure pad on the bottom. I guess that kind of makes sense.
Yeah. All right, anyway, I thought that was very weird. The next thing I have is something that just comes up occasionally whenever we talk about the Coleco Atom. The Coleco Atom has a requirement that you have a printer because the printer has the power supply.
Yes, that's amazing.
This is someone who is selling a, kind of like a newly fabricated printer replacement, which is a power supply that doesn't need the printer part. So it is if you don't have the printer or you don't want the printer, you can get this $125 Atom replacement power supply. I think it says they're sort of made to order, so if you order one, it's not going to come immediately. But it's still, that's a nice option, because I think there are a lot of orphaned Atoms out there that have no printer.
Yeah. Well, what's amazing is not only did they choose to remotely locate the power supply in a different peripheral, they chose the most useless peripheral. The one that not everybody's going to have and that is going to go away in a few years. Amazing.
Yeah. So, anyway, it's nice that that exists, I think, finally. I don't think I've come across that before when I've looked. I have a couple of books on my little list of things. This came up, and I just thought it was sort of interesting. It's a book from 1984 called A Guide to Playing the Hobbit for the BBC Micro. I thought this was kind of funny just because it is, you know, it's a book specifically about this this terrible game. So I think we covered this on episode 251, although it looks like I was the only one of us that was here for that. But the Hobbit was sort of one of the things that made it sort of special was that it like it had non-player characters who would go do things even out of your view. And could sometimes, like, you could send somebody out to go get something for you, and then he could randomly get killed, and then, like, you can't solve the game. You know, because two non-player characters interacted in a way that kept you from having the thing you need. So
we should say, though, fair warning, the entire United Kingdom is going to write you hate mail now for calling this game terrible, because apparently it was extremely popular there.
Huh.
You've got I see you have the Digital Antiquarian article mm-hmm. up about this game. This game was apparently immensely, immensely popular. I can only guess it's because they didn't have a lot of games to choose from at the time in the UK.
I'm not sure. Are you helping with this letter writing campaign?
No, now we're going to get more hate mail, but it's frankly kind of true. The software market was quite limited over there at the time. So I think it didn't take much to make people excited based on some of these games that were popular.
Yeah. Now, I think the story of The Hobbit is interesting. We definitely did talk about it back on episode 251. But if you don't want to go back to that, you know, just read some of these. Like the Digital Antiquarian specifically is a good place to read about this. But as I recall, they hired someone who had no experience with doing anything like this, and very very ambitious dreams about how to make something like this. And so anyway, there's you can buy a book to help you with this very difficult task of playing The Hobbit. The other book in the notes, I basically just had called this if you know any kids heading off to college soon, there's the College Student's Personal Computer Handbook from 1984, which I think is kind of neat, actually, in a way, because it's 1984 was a very different time of like college computing. But I kind of noticed it because it's a Cybex book, and they had a whole series of books that covered programming and all kinds of things. It was one of the major publishers, but so I know it as a one of those series.
So I guess it looked like from your flipping through the pictures there that it's sort of covering computing from a college student's perspective. So here's like how to write a paper, because that's something you're going to need to know how to do on a computer. So that's actually this would be kind of handy, I imagine, if you didn't have a computer at home and you were going off to some school where they had them and they were expecting you to use them. Mm-hmm. This might be helpful.
And I think it actually might be pretty interesting to just read what they thought was important.
And how do you write a book like this that is brand agnostic? I think that's often the challenge with a lot of these general purpose books about computers from the 80s were sort of useless because they can't talk about anything specific because they don't know what kind of computer you're on. Is it a mainframe? Is it a terminal? Is it an Atari? So the information ends up being so general as to be kind of useless. Like, you will save your file when you write a term paper, you know, that kind of helpful advice. But then no instructions for how to do that, of course, because they can't.
Although, if the only thing the book told you was to make a backup, it might have been worth the price.
Yeah.
Because I know a lot of people who lost stuff back then.
Yeah, I think the value here, which it looked like this book might be covering, is sort of the general habits of computing. Like, making backups, knowing that you need to save and load files, knowing that floppy disks exist and what they look like and kind of generally how they work. Like, as a primer, that would be actually helpful so that when you get to the school and they're going to show you how to use their specific computer, you at least have the broad concepts in your head.
The only last thing I think I will mention here is this may have come up before. I think it probably did. 1969 Cardiac Cardboard Illustrative Aid to Computation. It is a cardboard computer. and it's really from 1969, and it's pretty cool. So you punch it out of cardboard and put it together, and it can compute certain things. I have one. I was planning to scan it so that you could and, you know, do this virtually. And I haven't, but I'm sure someone else has. I think there must be a fair number of these out there, but it's still a very cool thing, and it is actually old.
The name is extremely clever, I have to say, because so it was from that period when, for some reason, we all decided computer names all had to end in EAC, IAC, and there was the all the different ones. So card EAC, because it's made of cardstock, which also happens to be a word you don't want to hear from your doctor probably, but it is it's a clever name because of the time period.
All right, so that's it for my eBay this time. Though I did want to put up one other thing, which I forgot to mention when we talked about the gift idea of David's documentary. But among the people on David's documentary, at the end in the credit sequence is our own Michael Mulhern. So,
yay, Michael!
Yeah. Hi, Michael.
I'm not sure where he is. He's surrounded by old computers and he's at a Mac. Anyway. So maybe this is in fact his bunker, but I don't know. But anyway, it's kind of neat that Michael made it into the documentary. Okay, let's see. I think that's it for eBay. So we can maybe now move to closing discussions. And Earl, you are alphabetically first and have written something there.
Just a little something, a little teaser. Randy and I just recorded another episode of Next Without Four. And the topic that we did this time was Chip 8. I don't know if you've heard of Chip 8, but it is it's a virtualized environment, but for extremely modest computing hardware. Started with one of the old RCA computers that had something like 4K of RAM and a 64 by 32 bitmap display. But they were able to still do a hexadecimal bytecode virtual machine for that would let you program in this bytecode, the specification. And so more efficient than BASIC. Like BASIC would be, you know, essentially wipe out your 4K if you tried to load a BASIC on there. But they managed to squeeze this interpreter into, I think, 512 bytes, if I'm remembering right. And then it became popular later with other computers that were limited in terms of their available RAM and graphics and that, and then ultimately made the jump to some of the graphics calculators that came out from TI. And anyway, I don't want to give much away, just wanted to say I really enjoyed learning about Chip 8. I'd heard of it, but had not really ever done a deep dive in it, and I found it to be extremely fascinating. And I mean, you think of a virtual machine these days, you think of something like, you know, the .NET Common Language Runtime or the Java VM or things like that, things that are just ginormous. And this fit into an infinitesimally small amount of RAM, but still accomplished the same result and was portable. So that was fun. And I'll let everybody know when the episode posts.
So I actually just learned a lot in that moment because I had heard of Chip 8, but my exposure to it was through, so it's become a somewhat hip microcontroller platform for developing very small games. So there are these boards you can buy. I think they're probably like Arduino based or something, but they come with a little like 32 by 40 or whatever pixel display. And people write little games for them. And they're like a little tiny game console. And you can, there's a whole community of people developing games for this. But I didn't realize that it had its roots that go that far back. So that's really cool. I guess everything's always older than you think it is in computing. So that's neat.
Yeah, from the 1970s. And the interesting thing about this, too, is that it seems like these days, because if you go out and Google for Chip 8 emulator, what you'll find is a lot of tutorials on how to create a Chip 8 emulator. It seems like it has become the hello world of people who are learning to write emulators. So, and probably because of the simplicity and the really elegant design, I think when I looked at it, I was like, oh my gosh, this is beautiful. This is beautiful code. So.
Yeah, and it's a very low barrier to entry because of that, because the platform is so small and it gives you, it's an interesting creative challenge to come up with a playable game in so few pixels. And so people are having a lot of fun doing that. People have come up with a lot of really neat games with just a handful of pixels. So yeah,
nice.
It's really cool.
Yeah, I was going to, so I'm not sure if this is related to the thing you're talking about, but there's been a thing sitting in our show notes of like possible topics to talk about. This has been here for 3 years, probably at least. But it was in there, it was mentioned that there was every October, there's a small group that do a game jam to make new Chip 8 games. And this may
be Octojam.
The Octojam,
I think it's called. Yeah. Unfortunately, the last year was the last year it was going to run. They may come back or they may be gone. It was just, it ran its course, but I think it ran for about 10 years. And in that time, there was a lot of software created as part of that game writing, whatever you want to call it, kind of party competition. And all of that software for Chip 8 is available if people want to go out and look at it.
Yeah, it does sound interesting. And it is nice that it's like there are, I think, a number of these sort of like limited targets that people use to try to write, you know, retro type games. But at least with this one, it seems like there's an audience. Like if you write something, there's a lot of people who might actually run it rather than on your little like dream retro machine.
Yeah, there are a lot of these kind of minimal fantasy platforms that people build. The Chip 8 seems to be one of the very, very few that has an actual traction. Like it has a community around it that are actively developing these games. There are many, many more of those platforms than there are communities that actually develop any traction. So Chip 8 is a good one for sure.
All right, let's see. I don't have very much on closing notes for myself. My office is slightly cleaner, but I still haven't addressed anything in it. Yeah, I tried to find something and came close to being able to find it. So that's progress, I guess. You know, I found things that are... I was looking for a book, and I found books by the same author. So, you know, that's I'm getting closer to being able to know where things are. But... anyway, yeah, that's. I think what I'm gonna try to do, you know, here in the future is really try to actually process some of these things that I have. You know, take out the next thing that I pick up and, you know, take a little video of doing something with it, and then probably give it to somebody else. But we'll see how that goes. So, Quinn, any closing notes?
Yeah, I've been busy. I got a lot going on right now, retro-wise. Last recording, I talked about my retro room downstairs has come together, so I've got my machines all set up on the desk. Now I'm working on getting them all running, which has been more of a project than I expected. I kind of thought they would all just turn on and be mostly working. That has not been the case. So right now I'm working on the 2GS, so quite to my surprise, because it's had a very good life, that machine. I fully expected it to just boot right up when I turned it on, and it does not. It's making a very high frequency clicking noise. Like it sounds to me like a 30 or a 60 hertz clicking noise coming from the power supply when I turn it on, and nothing else happens. So to my naive, untrained power supply ear, it sounds like the crowbar circuit, which is the short circuit detection that switching power supplies have in them. So it's basically trying to engage and then disengaging 60 times a second on the AC frequency because it's detecting a short somewhere. So I started by limiting variables. I took all the cards out and it was still doing it. So it's not a specific card that has something wrong with it. And then I just took it out of the machine entirely and powered it up on the bench and it's still doing it. So it seems to be a flaw internally to the power supply. All the capacitors look okay. Actually, behind me, you can see the guts of it on my bench there. So I've got the power supply torn apart and everything looks visually fine. There's no puffy caps or goo anywhere. So what I've decided to do is at this point, I'm going to have to start diagnosing things at a pretty low level. So I kind of figure, well, before I do that, I might as well just replace the guts if I'm going to do that anyway. So I ordered the replacement guts from Reactive Micro for the power supply. So I'm basically waiting for those to ship. And then I'll just replace the guts of it. And so I know the machine is alive because at one point it almost started working. I heard the startup whoosh from the Transwarp. So it started to work, and then the crowbar tripped again. So there's life in there. I'm 99% sure it's just the power supply is dead. Taking all of the cards out was an interesting adventure. I haven't done that since the machine was my daily driver in the early 90s. So one of the things I had to do to eliminate variables was to remove the Transwarp card. And for anyone not familiar...
Yeah, I was just going to ask about that.
Yeah, so the Transwarp GS, of course, it sits in a slot, but then it has this big ribbon cable that runs over to the CPU and replaces the CPU with a big connector. And so if you're going to take that out, it means you have to have the original CPU to put back in the hole. And I'm extremely proud to say I did have it. Mm-hmm. I have meticulously for decades been storing and moving the 65816 out of that machine on a little pad of anti-static foam. Somehow I've gone through my entire adult life never losing it. And it took me a while to find it, but I knew I had it. And it was stuffed in the back of one of my disc, 3.5-inch disc boxes. And so I put it back in, and sure enough, it still works. So... I'm getting closer. I'm pretty sure the new power supply will straighten it back up. Mm-hmm. And the purpose of getting that machine up first is that then I will be able to test my 2GS game that I've been working on real hardware. And that is, I guess I can announce it here first, that I'm calling that game finished. It's done, but I'm not going to release it until I can test it on real hardware, because I'm sure there will be bugs there. So far, I've only tested it on one emulator. So I want to test it on multiple emulators and also on real hardware before I call it officially done, but at least it's alpha, I guess, or beta. It's feature complete, and it's basically done. So that just happened today, actually. I finished up the last thing I wanted to do before the show, so that will be hopefully coming soon, as soon as I get the GS up and running again. And then I've got I ordered for the Commodore 64, I ordered a 1541 Ultimate, because one thing about the Commodore is that I've got all the hardware, but I don't really have any disks for it. It came with a handful of disks, but there wasn't really much there. I don't know why. I know that the guy I got it from had a lot of games, but I guess I didn't get the disks from him. I'm not sure why. So I need to get disk images for it, and so I need some kind of solid-state storage device from which to load disk images. And so I decided to order the 1541 Ultimate because Rob O'Hara talks about it all the time, so it's kind of the only one that I know on the Commodore. And it turns out that thing is crazy now, so it's much like the FujiNet, where it sort of does everything now. So it's not just a disk emulator now, it does networking, and it bakes bread, and it does all sorts of things. So...
nice piece of hardware. They don't give them away, but it's true
on both counts. Yeah, so it's on its way to me from the Netherlands or Germany, wherever they make those. But yeah, I will have a 1541 Ultimate soon. Very excited about that, so I can finally get some games going on that machine. And then I think that's it. Here's the other funny thing. So with my GS, I have the original SCSI hard drive that I had. I have a 40 megabyte SCSI hard drive for it, and it's external, and of course it needs a Terminator. speaking of Terminators, and I didn't that I could not find, and I am 99% sure I threw it out because I had a box of miscellaneous cables that when I moved back to Canada I mostly threw away because it was all really old stuff. Like I had a 75 ohm to 300 ohm RF converter. Like, you remember those? It was a bunch of stuff like that. I'm like, I'm not ever gonna need anything like this anymore. Everything's HDMI or whatever now. So I kind of threw out almost everything in that box. And I think I threw away my SCSI Terminator. So it turns out you can still buy them, amazingly. I went on Amazon, and you can still just buy SCSI Terminators on Amazon. Amazing. So I did that. So I'll be able to get the hard drive up and running again. And hopefully the disk is still good and all of my stuff is still on that hard drive. I don't know. It's like a decade of my childhood is sitting on that hard drive, possibly, or maybe it's all gone. I don't know. So I won't know until.
Was the Terminator one of those Amphenol connector types?
It's the Centronics type.
Yeah.
The big fat one with like 50 pins or whatever. Yeah.
So Quinn's in the Pacific Northwest and I'm in the Pacific Northwest. So you'd think I could just run her over one. but we're like a gajillion miles from each other. It's too bad because I actually have one of those in a drawer where I know I could just grab it for you. But
so close yet so far. Yeah. Yeah. As the crow flies, it seems like we're not that far apart, but it's actually like a 16-hour drive if you plot it out. So anyway, that arrived. And so I'll be able to get the drive up and running, hopefully. And that's basically it. So lots going on there with all that. Herb in the chat is asking if I got a keyboard for my GS, and I did. Yes, K-Fester very generously donated one to the Quindunky cause to help me get the machine up and running and help me release this game. So yes, I did get a keyboard and a mouse as well. So all set there.
I think maybe it was last time you were asking about, like, if there was someplace like... For the Apple, there's Asimov, this like archive of things, and I think you were wondering if there's something similar for the Commodore.
Yeah, or something like Total Replay, if there's some kind of image I can download that has like the best 100 games or whatever on it.
Is that something, Earl? You might know. It seems like this might be sort of in your wheelhouse. Is that something that you would know, like where these things live?
I am unaware of anything like Total Replay in terms of a nicely packaged compendium like that. I think there are a couple sites, but I got to say it's been so long since I've been out there looking around for them. I'd have to go refamiliarize myself.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm aware of Lemon 64.
Rob O'Hara talks about Lemon 64 a lot, so maybe I should go there. They might have an archive of images.
I think it's possible that they don't have images. They have info on a lot of games, but just seem to remember somehow Lemon 64 not actually having the disk images that you could download.
Okay. Yeah, that's enough of a legal gray area that maybe they don't want to touch that. I don't know. Mm. Yeah, that's always the problem with disk images. It's like, yeah, they're still kind of technically illegal to own them. So really reputable sites don't necessarily want to host them, but they might link you to them it's always the challenge. On the Apple, it's easier because all the companies that made that stuff no longer exist, so nobody cares.
Right.
A lot of those Commodore companies, like a lot of that stuff's owned by Activision now or by EA, so like these companies still exist. So, I mean, they're not likely to come after you for them, but still, if it's your business to run Lemon 64, maybe you don't want to put it at risk by hosting all of these files.
Right.
I could be wrong about that, though, so it doesn't hurt looking. And it never hurts looking at Lemon 64 anyway, because there's a lot of interesting things going on there. The forum there is very active, and if you need some help,
okay,
a lot of very knowledgeable people there.
I will check that out.
Yeah, the power supply thing that you were having with the 2GS, I have I have a Lisa 2, and it's I may have mentioned this before, but I bought it from John Woodall, who was in David's documentary, but he was selling it as what he said was basically you can buy a Lisa from somebody else. And then it will stop working, and then you will have a Lisa that doesn't work. Or you can buy this Lisa for me that already doesn't work. And so
interesting sales pitch. Okay.
Right. So I did buy that. But somehow it got like jostled in transit or whatever. But when I got it just for fun, I turned it on, and it did turn on. It had some problems. In fact, there was a very weird chip. There was the wrong chip was in the board. It took me a while to like figure this out, but there's a chip called a COPS something 421 or something like that is actually sort of responsible for a lot of the sort of soft power on and that kind of thing. There's a number of things that it's responsible for, but there was a clock chip in that spot. Nothing
weird.
Related at all.
Huh.
But anyway, point is, I know it's worked. I know I've used it and gotten it to do a couple things, but recently it hasn't done anything. And at least one of the power supplies that I have for it, I have a replacement which also doesn't seem to work, but it does that same clicking thing. I believe that is in fact there's something in the power supply that's shorting.
Yeah, and I did a thorough inspection on the board. Like the machine inside was spotlessly clean, so it's not like there was some rogue piece of crap or whatever that was shorting out a trace or something. The machine was was immaculate inside. So it has to be something like the big switching transistor has shorted internally or something. It has to be something like that. Yeah, that's my best guess. And yeah, it's at a point where it's like, well, rather than spending a lot of time figuring out what's wrong with it, it'd be just quicker to just replace the guts with modern stuff. So it's funny, I can sort of relate to your thing about the wrong chip, though. Mm-hmm. When I went to put the 65816 back into the CPU slot, the board does not mark pin 1 for that chip. Mm. So I didn't know which way to put it back in. So I ended up Googling images of 2GS motherboards, and I didn't want to rely on just one image off eBay or whatever. So I looked at like 10 different images to sort of figure out, okay, which, and they all had the 65816 the same way. So I was able to figure out which way to put it back in. But it's like, geez, that'd be a terrible mistake to make. You sort of assume, and it's not the way you think either. You'd think the number one chip would be top left, which is kind of the convention, but it's not. That chip is kind of upside down, as it were, in the slot. So it would be an easy thing to get wrong if someone was taking it apart to clean it or something.
Yeah.
Thing to guess. I'm going to be spending a few bucks with Reactive Micro pretty soon, too. Amazingly, they make an Apple III guts for the power supply like they do the Apple II. And when I tried the Apple III that I have and it didn't work, first thing I checked was the power supply, and lo and behold, it wasn't giving good voltages. So, which, you know, kind of makes sense. I mean, that's a known failure point on the twos and threes. So,
yeah. And frankly, any computer, that's the thing likely to fail, especially over time, because the power supply is what gets all the stress, the heat and the thermal cycling, and it's shifting all the current. So yeah, the power supply is the thing that's going to go wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a basic 80s computer motherboard, there isn't very much to go wrong, honestly, aside from things like batteries leaking. Like, it's all low integration, solid state stuff. There's really nothing that can go wrong short of chips being loose in sockets or other physical abuse to the board. So yeah.
Yeah.
Also, I have to note that I didn't pick it up 3 inches and drop it. So yeah. I didn't actually attempt that repair mode. So maybe I should try that. I'm not going to do it.
I'm pretty sure that in fact, actually only relates to the very first kinds that got recalled. So if your serial number was below 14,000, then it might work, but otherwise.
And it's not, because I'd shared it with you, actually, Paul, and you noted that it was out of the recall range.
Yeah. The Reactive Micro's power supplies are actually, they're universal for a fairly large range of, you know, Apple IIs and III. It just basically, you break off some part of the board, so it fits in the space for the particular computer.
Yeah, and they sell different cables, because the cable that connects to the motherboard is a little bit different. So there's one for the GS and one for the 2Es, and other than that, I think they're universal.
I really wish I could do something like that with the Lisa, but in fact, if I'm not mistaken, the Lisa power supply also has in it like the video control circuitry.
Oh, geez.
Apple. Because it has these, it has little, sticks that you turn that stick out that you change, something about the video geometry.
So they probably put the high voltage CRT stuff in the same can as the power supply, because that lets them control EMI and keeps the high voltage stuff isolated.
Could be.
So I guess sort of elegant in a way, but a pain in the butt for you now.
Right. So now I actually probably do need to most likely hand it to somebody and say, check this and see if that's broken. But
take it to Thark and he'll sort it out for you.
Right, exactly. Okay, let's see. It's possible that this is going on longer than it ought to in the end, but this has been fun. I have to find my script now. What do I say at the end? Here it is. So that is it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can find lo-fi episodes and more via Gopher, also at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org somewhere, we think. You can follow RCR on Mastodon. We are RCR Podcasts at podcasts.social. And I think that's actually the only place that we emit the announcement that we are going to record, usually like an hour and a half before it happens. Maybe we can do better. But at any rate, if you follow us on Mastodon, you will see those toots. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network. again, allegedly, I haven't actually checked this anytime recently, but throwbackreviews.com. And please write a review on iTunes if you wish. And until next time,
Retro Compute.
Wow, that was amazing.
Wasn't that?
Yeah, not bad. All right. Oh, Quinn, could you say ADT Pro again?
ADT Pro?
Yeah, perfect. Because you had it switched around and I will swap it in. I think you said ATD Pro.
Did I? Oh, okay. Should I do three or four reads of that line
sounds,
so you can pick the best
one?
That
sounds perfect. Yeah.
ADT Pro. ADT Pro. ADT Pro. There you go. One of those will work. I'm a pro.
Tron DD asks, what's Quinn's motivation in this scene?
Probably cynicism. That's my motivation for most things.
Right.
That's harder to say than one might think. ADT Pro. ATD. Yeah, my brain wants to say ATD because it's easier. ATD is easy.
ADT.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly where I go to.
That's probably it. Yes, my brain has Hayes modem command still in it, taking up valuable space that could be used to remember where I left my keys.
Right. Yeah, I often think that about remembering opcodes. You know, 6502 opcodes. Why do I know that, you know, how to clear the carry?
Yeah, exactly. Or the RTS is 60. Yeah.
There's a license plate with LDA something after it. And I was like, yeah, that's where my brain went.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure Carrington has a 6502 license plate, or at least did.
I think that's true. Yeah, I think he did.
Didn't we? I believe we actually had. I am maybe not remembering the story, and in fact, Quinn, you may have been the one telling this story, but I think there were actually assembled at Kansas Fest several cars that had 6502 license plates.
Oh, that could be, yeah, from all the different states. Yeah, yeah, I think Carrington had it on his Jeep, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know if he still has that Jeep, though. Yeah.
All right, anyway.